Let's get started. First, let's start with the credential issue. There is a massive problem with credential reuse. And even just as recently as yesterday, I had a conversation with a client who was asking me about, well, Felicia, what do? For password management. And I said, well, I've been using a password management application for years, and I keep it up to date, and I use a 22-character password to get into it, and I utilize a local key fob token that I have physical. So it's that physical thing that's also required to get into it, and it uses a high-quality encryption. So you then need to have multiple pieces in order to access the contents of that password safe. And I mean, I have over 1,000 passwords. And that is because I use password management best practices, which is utilizing a unique password for just about everything. And that's really crucial. I mean, I don't know what the average human's limit is that they can remember in terms of passwords, but I'd guess it would be somewhere around 20 passwords or less. So there's way too many problems associated with password reuse. And as a result, you have to use a password management application. I'd recently talked to another client about saying, hey, everybody in the accounting department should probably be using a shared password safe. Because if you're an accounting department, you're inevitably going to be needing to log on to the payroll website and the bank websites and all kinds of other websites for the business that you are part of the accounting department for. And you need to have, shared responsibility as well as business continuity. If one person's out of the office, then another person can get into the things. But in the meantime, you also need to be managing that content securely. And I think you all are aware that most bank websites, as well as most good websites that you log into and sign up for an account with, require you to change your password every now and then. And so, let's say accountant number one logs into the bank website, and on that particular login event, it says, oh, you have to change your password. Well, then they ought to be able to update that password, create a new password, utilizing the password generation rule sets that are specified for each individual entry in the password safe, and then generate a new password and go ahead and update the password. And then when accountant number two the next day needs to go into that account, then they have all that information currently. So, I mean, it's fantastic from a business continuity standpoint, but you also have to make sure that unauthorized parties are not able to get into that. And the way that you do that is that you utilize a password that is known to those key individuals, but then each one of those key individuals also has a token, such as a YubiKey, that is utilized to open that password safe as the second factor of authentication. And with regards to password safes, I can't stress enough the importance of having a solution that is available to you offline. So if you were to utilize a password management application that was purely online, that really isn't going to do you any good. Especially from an IT perspective, because if your internet connection is down and you happen to need that password to be able to get to, something that's on premise, well, you can't. I mean, it's just ridiculous. A good example of that is, let's say you had a very special password that you used to decrypt a particular volume. Well, if your internet connection is down at the time, or if the hosted service provider for the password management application is down, that's no good. So I don't recommend online password management applications for holistic use. For targeted special use for IT purposes, they can be okay. And of course, you always have to be concerned about the scenarios associated with, well, what if that service provider gets compromised? Yeah. So, I mean, that's something that has to be, you have to be concerned about. And there have been password management service providers that have been compromised. Now, fortunately, they were also smart enough to utilize special layers of protection that prevented their password storage database contents from being compromised, even when, say, a front-end application got compromised. So far, nobody's actual password management database contents have been compromised, at least not that's in within the knowledge of the public domain. You know, maybe the FBI knows about it and I don't. That's possible. So this whole password reuse can be avoided, and it must be avoided because password reuse is catastrophically bad. Mark Zuckerberg himself just recently had his Twitter and Pinterest accounts compromised because his credentials from the LinkedIn breach from several years ago, this is where it gets really bad. LinkedIn's passwords were breached approximately 3 years ago. Now that's like 3 years ago, okay? And first of all, anybody at that time should have gone in and changed their passwords, and they should have never been utilizing the same password everywhere. And you should have two-factor authentication turned on your LinkedIn account and your Pinterest account and your Twitter account, right? All these accounts. Well, not Mark Zuckerberg. No, apparently, his LinkedIn password was identical to the password for Pinterest as well as Twitter. And as a result, well, it was all compromised. All three accounts were compromised. And so the reality is that here, this guy's supposed to be the head of Facebook. And apparently, either he delegated access to set that up to somebody who doesn't know how to follow IT security standards and best practices, or he himself doesn't understand IT security standards and best practices. Either way, I don't find it to be acceptable. But, you know, if he's doing it, then that says to me that, you know, Facebook is clearly not a company that you should trust. But I mean, I never trusted them from the beginning. So you need to be utilizing different passwords for every single website that you use. You really should be using multi-factor authentication for everything where possible. And this was really the only way you can avoid these sorts of problems because websites are getting hacked all the time. I mean, probably every shopping website that you interact with has been hacked at some point in time or another. And whether or not your credentials for that website were exposed really has to do with, are they storing the passwords in a hash? Are they salting the hash? You know, how all are they doing it in plain text? And then if it is exposed, then did you use that password anywhere else? Hopefully the answer to that is no. And one of the ways that you can handle that issue is to do to utilize a proper password management application and not do password reuse. Okay. So that's a big hot thing in the news lately is all kinds of people having problems because of password reuse, and it's just completely unnecessary. I published an article on how to use YubiKey with PasswordSafe. It's on the website. It's great. It's a step-by-step process that actually teaches you how to use a YubiKey with PasswordSafe. So, in my opinion, at this point in time, there's just really no reason for you to be not knowing how to do that. There's plenty of good documentation that's been published on that, and the article that I published really demystified all of the complexity of getting that set up because I take you through it step by step, including screenshots. So, let's move on to the whole people filing tax returns utilizing your Social Security number with a fake W-2 and getting a refund. So this This has happened less this year than last year, so that's good. There's been some positive movement there, but there's still a lot of issues associated with individuals going to file their taxes and finding out that the IRS is rejecting their tax return because somebody else has already filed under that Social Security number. And in fact, I talked to a business owner whose business had been compromised from an IT perspective. Obviously, they're not one of my clients, and because that wouldn't happen to them. And they were pretty sure that Social Security numbers and their payroll information had been leaked as part of that breach. And so, sure enough, just a few weeks later, when that business owner went to go and file their taxes, it got kicked back and rejected by the IRS, where the IRS was saying, nah, somebody's already filed under that Social Security number. So when that happens, I mean, it's a big, big issue to try and unwind that. And I talked to some CPAs who were able to give me trending information about how long this has been going on. Is it worse now than, last year? Is it better? What's the story? And they're telling me that in some cases, it can take over a year to actually get your real refund once this sort of an identity theft has happened to you. So I hope you didn't need that refund real bad. And if you did, then I suggest you take the security of your stuff a little more seriously, right? And on that same topic, I've also heard about some doctors who were putting together a lawsuit against their employer, who was the hospital, and the hospital got breached, and these doctors were getting pretty hacked off, and rightly so, because their personally identifiable information, their identity, was stolen as part of this breach, and they were getting together and suing the hospital. So the reason that this is really important is that if you happen to be a business owner and you think that you don't need to be spending money on security and finding a proper security qualified IT consultant, of which I'll be very blunt, there are very, very few out there. And if you think you don't need those kinds of services, then what you're effectively doing is accepting the risk of not only getting fined by the government, but also having your own employees sue you because of identity theft that resulted from a breach. So think about it. There is cybersecurity insurance out there, but it isn't necessarily going to cover a problem like that. And I guarantee you that any amount of money that you put into prevention is exponentially less in cost to you as a business owner than the cost of the breach, fixing the breach, if it can even ever actually really be fixed, and then the damages that might occur from either lawyer fees or a civil lawsuit brought against you by your own employees as a result of the breach. So, taking that context one step further, it has been very obvious now that even in a residential situation, you cannot have simply a host-based security product and think that your computers are going to be okay. And I've seen it now twice in the last 6 months. That having all the right parts and pieces in place, except for a perimeter security appliance solution, that isn't good enough. So even in a residential scenario, you need to have a perimeter security appliance solution. And these things are going to cost you about $1,000 for a 3-year appliance, and So when you think about that from an annual perspective, you know, you're talking about $334 or $333 per year. And the question you have to ask yourself is, well, what's the cost of my system getting broken? And I'm not even talking about the cost to you of your data getting exposed or, you know, broken, whatever. But what does it cost you if your computer ends up broken because some piece of malware got on it and your host-based security product may have done a good job of stopping it from doing a lot of damage and of really breaking the computer entirely, but you keep finding little teeny problems here and there that are persistent and annoying, and you know that, oh, well, yeah, that malware, for the few milliseconds that it was actually executing on the computer before the host-based security product was able to stop it, it had done damage up to that point in time, and that damage is substantial enough to cause problems for you. And this is now the world we live in. So if you think you can live without a full-fledged host-based secure a full-fledged perimeter security appliance as the perimeter and core of your network, even in a residential setting, that's not consistent with the evidence that I'm seeing these days. So that takes us into the topic of this ransomware and malware that keeps getting worse. It's now to the point where the new Cerber ransomware that there was a June 2nd article that was published, and I'm publishing a link to that article on Invincia. This stuff morphs every 15 seconds. Now, the thing you got to realize with ransomware is that, first of all, it's an advanced persistent threat. It is not signature based. So that means that a signature based detection system is completely ineffective against that, which means you have to have products that have ransomware protection, advanced persistent threat blocking, IPS and IDS capabilities. Then, if it's changing every 15 seconds, how are you ever going to actually detect it and stop it? How is it that any sort of a host-based security product is going to detect it and stop it? Now, this isn't the first time that I've seen self-propagating and altering, you know, self-altering viruses. I've seen those viruses for at least the last 8 years. And those viruses were incredibly persistent, very difficult to get rid of, but you could actually get rid of them. Nowadays, though, every time I see one of these things, what it is that it has done, either you can't get rid of it, or it has done so much damage to the system that you end up having to restore it from an image from, say, last week or the week before or whatever. Simply a system restore, utilizing the built-in Windows system restore functionality, that doesn't cut the mustard. I mean, it does not accomplish the objective. That malware seems to have gone pretty deep and nasty. So this article by Invincia that's talking about the Cerber ransomware morphing every 15 seconds, it's a pretty astonishing little sweet little read. It's talking about how it originated from a weaponized Office document that was delivered through Outlook in this particular case that Invincia was investigating. And this just brings up the whole point of, if you don't have an advanced persistent threat detecting and blocking, so a ransomware detecting and blocking capability built right into the email system that you have. I'm not talking about Outlook. By the time it's actually shown up in your Outlook mailbox, it's a little too late at that point. But you need to have something that's actually plugging directly into your mailbox or plugging into your Office 365 tenant or filtering out all of this stuff actually before it's even delivered to your mailbox. in the world's ideal scenario, you would have multiple layers of protection that would be filtering it before it got to your mailbox and then also sandboxing it once it was into your mailbox. And yes, this is the system that I use. So only in that circumstance is that weaponized office document, like a Word document or an Excel spreadsheet, PowerPoint, even PDF files are weaponized. Only in that circumstance do you have protections for detecting these nasty things and eliminating them by the time they get to your mailbox. So if you happen to be an IT manager of an organization, I think you can understand that it's probably a fruitless activity to try to train your staff how to detect and not open, like, oh, don't open that Word document or don't open that Excel attachment. And the reality is that a single Excel macro virus or a Word macro virus can potentially do so much damage to your organization that whatever money you would have spent on the proactive mitigation strategies is infinitesimally small compared to the damage. I mean, I remember in 1997, the I Love You virus hit several corporations and mid-sized businesses that were local to the Racine, Kenosha area. And I say 1997 because this is nothing new, right? I mean, this sort of a problem has been going on for 2 decades now. And at that time, it was still pretty easy to mitigate that risk, but the IT departments that were hit in 1997, they were just negligent. I mean, I'm going to be blunt. They were negligent. It was totally preventable. It was just all so easy for them to handle, but they decided to not be proactive about it. And it ended up costing these companies a ton of money to, I mean, obviously, way more money to fix the problem than it would have cost them to be proactive about mitigating these risks. So you really got to start changing your mindset about it. And all of this stuff is interrelated. Something else that I found really fascinating was another kind of related article by Invencio, where they were talking about new methods for distributing malware using the built-in Windows internal tools. And very shockingly, they're actually these bad guys are now utilizing the cert utility that is built into Windows to do base 64 decoding of their malware and to actually make it look like a payload that's supposed to be on the system. And this is rather complex. And it can actually, well, just the best way to describe it is stuff that isn't really what it's not really what it is. It's weaponized bad things on systems that's pretending to be something that's legitimate. And then all of the challenges associated with detecting that and preventing it and all that. And if you're interested in that, by all means, check out the article associated with that, as I do have that linked. And it's just really important stuff that you should be aware of is this general theme of you have to have strategies in place that are going to mitigate these risks before the bad stuff ever gets to the endpoint. So you have to have systems in place that are stopping it at the network layer, that are stopping it at whatever layers exist prior to that bad stuff getting delivered to your systems, your endpoints, the workstations, the servers, the mobile devices, the tablets, etc. Because it seems like once it actually gets on the endpoint, you don't have any mitigation system anymore that can completely eliminate the risk. At that point, you're just going to hope that your systems don't let it propagate any further, and that the damage that it's done is at least limited to the endpoint, that it's been delivered to. So let's move on to what the situation is right now with a lot of medical software packages. And this is really relevant not only to business owners of medical practices, but also their patients. And I think you all know that for years and years, I've been talking about how it seems as though the medical software makers are really behind the times with regards to getting their software to be in compliance with IT security standards and best practices, which I might add is a specification in the HIPAA regulations from March 2009. So the March 2009 HIPAA regs stated that the systems involved in medical practices and medical facilities and medical insurance, etc., must adhere to IT security standards and best practices. And those IT security standards and best practices have been widely known, publicly available for roughly 20 years, and the National Institutes of Standards and Technology is one of the best publishers of what that looks like. And there's so much of this that has been so ragingly obvious, but yet, so keep in mind here, we're talking about March 2009, and yet only this month, June 2016, have I seen software applications that are finally enforcing those standards. I mean, this is how bad the situation is. So medical practices have literally just gotten away with not adhering to HIPAA, between now and 2009. And I'll go one step further. I actually had a very lengthy conversation with a software company for the chiropractic industry. It's practice management software. And I was calling them because I was telling them about how their application will not work unless it is executed with administrative privileges. So why is this the case? Well, it's because these people originally wrote software way back in the day for, oh, something like Windows 2000 and the architecture that was in place at the time. And that was when user account control didn't exist. And then user account control came by and they're like, nah, just keep running our software as an administrator. Now, this is now 16, in excess of 16 years later. And Windows 10 will not allow you to disable user account control and still use these applications, whereas Windows 7 would. So their application now, with the way that they've got it written, will not be HIPAA compliant. I mean, I'm not saying it was ever HIPAA compliant, but there were ways to protect the system and still use the application if you were smart enough to do it. They didn't know how to do it, but I had figured out ways to make that application work and be HIPAA compliant. So I literally ended up having this lengthy conversation with them, talking about when are you guys going to fix the code in your medical practice management software? And I talked to their product engineering support manager. And he bluntly said to me, "We will not change the coding of the software." And I said, "You do realize by your incompetence and your lack of willingness to fix the underlying code of your software, you are creating massive liability for every chiropractic doctor who utilizes your software package, because if they utilize your software package with Windows 10 or in the way that you prescribe it to be used, they can never achieve actual real HIPAA compliance. They will always be accepting a risk and they will be accepting some liability because of your incompetence." So I say this because this is the reality of the world that we live in today. And as a patient, this impacts you. And I'm just disgusted by people's lack of willingness to actually do what they need to do in order to have secure systems. So that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, please do send me your feedback. I like to hear about it. Thanks.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Attention all Facebook users, you're invited to click Like WGTD for breaking news, photos, station program information, links to archives, and to interact with WGTD employees and listeners. The page is available to